When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, it's David Averin, and welcome to the Why Customers Leave podcast. So here's a question. Who is your customer or client? I'm not talking about your demographically niche target market, but who? The person, the people on the other side of the transaction, the human beings, the good people with rich, meaningful lives or profound struggles who you encounter and hope to engage in business and hope to build relationships with. Well, my guest today is a master of the human condition. You might have seen Neil Ford relay one of his inspirational stories or life lessons online. And today, we are going to explore the strategy and methodology behind the internet sensation that is Neil Ford. I'm David Averin, and this is the Why Customers Leave podcast, back in 20 seconds.
Are you ready to future-proof your business? Well, sit back, because customer experience expert David Averin brings you the Why Customers Leave podcast, featuring outspoken thought leaders and business builders as they share their creative strategies for serving a new generation of customers and clients. Listen in, or you can watch the video version of the conversation. Now, here's David Averin.
And thanks, and welcome to the Why Customers Leave podcast. Today is a treat. You do not, if you have a chance to watch the video version of this, just go to my website or go to the YouTube channel. Of course, we're on all the other podcast platforms as well. But today, I have the great privilege of talking with my man crush. I am such a big fan of Neil Ford, advertising genius. I mean, what a great background, everything else. I'll give the quick introduction in a minute, but a lot of people might know him from his internet videos and the spelling of his name. Even if you're starting to listen to this or watch it and you have a second, you can pause it or you can go online and take a look. Neil, N-E-A-L, and it's F-O-A-R-D. And I'm sure you've seen it. I'm sure it's a video that somebody has passed along to you because it spoke to them. Something about not only the stories themselves. We know so many people are talking about the value of stories, but there's a mannerism, there's a message, there's a kindness and a warmth behind this that has earned him a legion of fans. We're going to talk about that more today. Let me do a quick formal introduction. Neil Ford has spent 25 years in advertising and marketing, creating award-winning campaigns for global brands like Toyota, heard of them, Budweiser, Sony. He's the author of an innovative creative coaching series. He was named Worldwide Director of Creative Learning for global advertising juggernaut, Saatchi & Saatchi. Neil has been charged with conceiving effective brand experiences that help brands treat customers like friends instead of targets. Beautifully said. Most recently, he gained a following on social media for his inspirational videos about the kindness of everyday people. He has been called a modern sage by me and a welcome messenger for a tired and cynical world. Neil Ford, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, David. It's such a pleasure to be on with you.
Absolutely. This is what a great connection. We've connected online before, but it's the first time we've had a chance to have that conversation in person. I'm interested in having a conversation to understand sort of the genesis of where you are today, because it's easy to just jump to the success of the storytelling and the things that you've done online. We're going to delve a little bit more, but tell me a little bit more about your background so I understand where was the wisdom born? Where was the perspective that drove your current approach marinated?
My career was in advertising and marketing. But I really didn't start out that way. I left high school and didn't get to college right away. And I wound up working in a factory. And, I developed a kind of humility from that. There was a way back when I was a kid, Oakland, relative to San Francisco, had a real chip on its shoulder because San Francisco was where all the cool people were and was all the cool stuff was happening. And I remember hearing once from a San Franciscan who heard I was from Oakland. And he said, you know what the best thing about Oakland is? The view of San Francisco. And we carried around this kind of chip. And I discovered that I had that same chip before I went off to college, you know, that you develop where you're feeling like, you know, I don't think the working guy gets enough respect. And then when I got out of college, I did the same thing. I wound up in a couple of blue collar jobs working in a lumber yard and doing some demolition. And what that did for me was, whenever I heard the word consumer, I thought to myself, what a pompous phrase. On the other end of every purchase is a human being. This, by the way, David, is why I'm so stoked to be talking to you.
And how old were you at the time? Give me a time reference.
Well, I mean, like, you know, when I first started out and I got out of high school, I would have been about 17. And then when I got out of college, I was 21.
It's a profound observation for a young person.
Well, I think I'm hypersensitive, like in a bad way. Like I got real thin skin about critiques and so forth. But anyway, nevertheless, what happened was I can't stand bullies. And the first thing that a bully doesn't realize is there's a human being on the other end of their torment. And it struck me that the advertising industry was very much like that, where they didn't have sufficient respect for the people they were talking to. And as I was saying before, you seem to really have your finger on something, okay? Because you're saying, look, let's think of these people as having a relationship with us. You know, I'll give you one thing that struck me when I was working on Anheuser-Busch business. We walked into the St. Louis headquarters one day, and in big brass letters on their wall, they had this marvelous motto, and it was, making friends is our business. And I thought, oh, I will never see a corporate motto that good ever again. Just think about it. I go, making friends is our business. That is a good business to be in. And it struck me that any kind of communication for any product, whether it's a car or a banking service or insurance or whatever, it should have as its first obligation, what is it going to take to turn this person into a friend? Like, I want them to, whenever they think of me, I want them to think first, wow, I'm glad I know them. And not every business does that. They don't walk into every transaction thinking, what's it going to take to turn this person into a friend? You know, Dave, you might have had this experience. You go to an airline or you go to a hotel, and there's something about that person at the hotel. They just have the knack.
Yeah.
Right? They just make you feel welcome. So I was staying at a Ritz-Carlton, and they're incredibly professional. But I also stayed not a week later in one of those little Courtyard by Marriotts. And this gal behind the counter was just so frisky and funny and so keen to remember what I liked, so that the next time I saw her, she would be able to do it, you know, better. I just thought, wow, I don't know who got hold of her and trained her, or maybe she just came out of the factory this way. But I feel, and you know, the Ritz is so famous for its customer service.
Right, of course.
But this gal had it. She had that magic. And, you know, it made me feel as good about the Courtyard by Marriott as I felt about the Ritz-Carlton, which is superb. You know,
right. And individuals can do that. But let me throw something back, because you and I both work with sales professionals, representatives from organization, and they always parrot the lines that for us, it's about the relationship. They don't use the word friendship, but they want to build a relationship. We want to build a relationship. Yeah. But what's interesting is, conversely, I don't see a lot of customers, clients, prospects, whatever you want to call them, looking for a relationship. They're looking for a good product. They're looking for an easy transaction. Now, they'll stay for the relationship. They'll appreciate a relationship, but they're not looking for a relationship. They're looking for something to meet a need. And so I see a big disconnect right there. They appreciate relationships. I'll talk to business owners and leaders, and they'll say, what's your competitive advantage? What's your secret sauce? And they'll say, it's this, it's the relationship. And I said, no, that's a retention tool, right? What's your attraction? What is it that, because I think they don't use the word friendship. They see a relationship, but they want it because they want a long-term transaction, right? Mm-hmm. And so give me your perspective on that disconnect, because you have that epiphany at a young age. All salespeople talk about it, but I'm not sure that they understand what the customers are really looking for.
Well, I'll give you one slant on it, which is
that, yeah, please.
I had a lot of experience working on the Toyota brand, and I started out as a very young guy working on Toyota, and I had a kind of a snob opinion about it, which is that they weren't very exciting. They're much cooler now, but back then it was pretty much, you know, it was the Toyota Corolla. You know what I mean? It's like,
we had one.
And they're effing fantastic cars. But anyway, back then I sort of looked down my nose at it. And because it wasn't exciting. But over time, I started to really I started to really respect where it was coming from, like a vehicle like that, which was they were so proud of the fact that when you bought one of these things, it was going to be so reliable, so trouble-free, so dependable. You'd come to think of it almost like a horse, like you'd fall in love with it because it never let you down. And the mindset of Toyota was so long-term. Like they would, I'll give you an example of what I mean by their, the whole corporation, the way they would go long-term. They have this fantastic factory in San Antonio, Texas. It's gorgeous. And it turns out fantastic trucks. They make pretty much all the trucks that they sell in America, they make them in San Antonio, the Tundras and the Tacomas and so on. And they make it a point that whatever community they go into, that community is way better off than if they hadn't come in. One small example being the water that goes into the San Antonio plant comes out cleaner than it went in. And because they got to be real sensitive about the water table in San Antonio. Sure. But they're not just sensible about how they use it. They make sure that as a member of that community, it's going to be better that they're there than if they hadn't been there. And they do that all over the world. It's their approach. They treat their towns, they treat their people, they treat their customers with so much long-term respect. You're going to be glad you knew me. You know, 10 years from now, you're never going to have to apologize for something I've done. And, you know, just like a lot of other car companies, they've had recalls. But in almost every example, people that have gone through a Toyota recall are happier than if the recall had never happened, because Toyota handles the recall so classily, so overkill on making sure that they do right by their customers. You go, look, everybody makes mistakes, but nobody recovers like Toyota. And that to me is an example of a company that will, no matter what's happening in EV or whatever that, you know, happens to cars, Toyota's going to be in the transportation business well into the 22nd century. I feel pretty confident.
So here's the question though. How do we impart that story? Do we do it organically by just those who've had a great experience, or is there a conscious effort, not a predetermined or I'm trying to think of the best word. It's not calculated. They're doing the right thing because they need to do the right thing, right? Legally, ethically, morally. But is there a strategic effort to communicate that? Do we just do good work and hope that the marketplace figures it out?
Yeah, I don't think you can. I don't think you can entirely count on the marketplace to figure it out because, people have a very limited mind space. They got a lot of things to worry about.
Right.
This is why it's so important for any brand to kind of have a word that immediately springs to mind when anybody thinks of you. For decades, for Volvo, it was like, if you said Volvo, they'd go, oh, safety.
Safety, right.
And you'd say Toyota, and they go, reliable, or some version of that. And but what I believe that any brand can do when it's out in the world is to celebrate its tribe. That is, every communication should be a love letter to the people that dig what you do. And I'll give you an example of, like, Anheuser-Busch, for example, when they would advertise around Christmas, you knew they were going to do a Clydesdale ad.
Absolutely.
And it was going to be a lovely, genuinely heartfelt
celebration. Tug at the heartstrings. Sure.
Oh, and they've done some beautiful ones over the years. You know, like Dalmatian and a Clydesdale.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Right?
Yeah. We can think of all of those.
Right, right. Exactly. They spring to mind so easily because storytelling has that capacity to hit a heartstring, to make you go, oh yeah, dang, I hadn't thought of it that way. And so Anheuser-Busch also for years and years did working man advertising. It would celebrate, the wonderful everyday things that people would do with one another because they had old fashioned values.
Yeah. I think there was one with Paul Harvey narration.
I wouldn't surprise me.
One of the best.
Yeah. Oh God, I love Paul Harvey. What I believe for any company, like say a Toyota, is to its advertising should be a love letter to the people that dig what they do. And that means a celebration of people who are stalwart and intrepid and don't give up and try to do the right thing. And, you know, there are so many beautiful ways to do that. They did the most marvelous Olympic ads that featured athletes that had been, that were handicapped in some way. Right. And they do these beautiful sentiments around something we can all agree in. And you walk away with something so long lasting and such an emotional impression. You don't even know that the next time that you see the brand, you can't trace back why you just want them to win, but you do.
Right.
And in that sense, go ahead.
I was going to say, tell me really quickly from your experience though, I want to talk about that because it was a departure from the traditional features and benefits. It was a departure from the great catchy jingle that you remember it in your mind. To do that kind of institutional advertising that doesn't necessarily talk about the product or the price in the early days, that had to have been a hard sell.
Yeah, you're 100% right.
Because how do you measure the ROI on that one?
Well, okay, so you're absolutely correct. So, I knew a lot of Toyota dealers, and they were like any group of people. They were on a spectrum, and some people were real hard chargers, and they were very much as you were suggesting, which is all about the price, and you got to sell the car. I mean, sell it like it's on sale. And then there were other guys that go, "Come on, the product is so bulletproof. I don't understand why you're just not talking about that." The Toyota dealers were, like any group of people, they were on a spectrum, and some were super aggressive about making sure that they wanted every message to be about how the product was on sale. And then there was at the other end, the dealers that were real true believers, true believers that the product was superior. And there was never any reason to do anything except to talk about the superior of the product because that would inflate its value. And when they came in and talked price, they would, pretty much accept anything. Okay. Well, we were always having this argument about this phrase. The phrase was, there may never be a better time to buy than right now. Now, it used to drive me crazy because of this. If you really unpack that phrase, there may never be a better time to buy than right now. Is that a lie? No. But it's equally true that there may be a better time to buy than right now. When a statement is equally true and untrue, it's essentially inert. It offers you nothing.
Right.
It has no. It may have calories, but it has no nutritional value. And it bothered me that they didn't intend for people to hear it the way they said it. They only intended them to misinterpret what they'd said. The ones that loved the phrase wanted people to think, oh, they just said there will never be a better time to buy than right now. They were being intentionally deceptive. And that struck me as so not Toyota. And what else? It struck me as the bulk of the dealers, despite the reputation of car dealers, the bulk of the dealers were super cool. They were doing the best they could to deliver awesome service. And there was one dealer in particular I used to love. His favorite phrase was, "I'll lose a little money to make a friend." And the reason he was willing to do that was he knew that when you had a loyal customer, you would wind up selling them about 12 cars, right?
Yeah.
So the lifetime value of, he was big into lifetime value, and he was a killer, man. This guy made so much money because he was always so good to people. But anyway, my point going back to, okay, but what do you say about the brand? The ones that believed in phrases like, "I'll lose a little money to make a friend," the ones that believed that the product message should be a love letter to the people that buy it, ultimately they wound up being incredibly successful and beloved in their communities. And the others, I won't use some of the phrases, but they were pretty salty phrases about where they wound up.
But isn't it the difference between those who are perceived as transactional and those who are relational? I mean, that's, we see that, but it comes from having a long view and of your business. And even when, I speak for a living, and even when we lose a gig, and we already have our speakers this year, but we'll look at you for next year. And it's like, that's good. I got to pay my mortgage next year too. Right.
Yeah.
And be able to and to build those relationships. But let's go back to stories. Now, of course, stories have come far more mainstream. Doesn't mean it's always done well to help create the story for the brand. Right.
Mm.
Talk to us about the elevation of understanding and recognition for the value of that and those who do it well and those who don't. I mean, talk about the current state of storytelling sort of in brand development and communicating, I was going to say value proposition, but we'll leave it at that.
Well, I'll tell you
what's the current state there.
Yeah. So it's a funny thing that as you suggest, the very term storytelling is kind of in vogue right now.
Very much.
Will it ever go out of style? Well, the term will go out of style, but the art form will not. And here's how I know that. Because it's the original art form. It's not the world's oldest profession, but it is the thing that it's the thing our brains have been built to do. For example, it is very not hard to imagine a bunch of cave people sitting around in front of a fireplace 100,000 years ago and essentially having the same conversations we're having right now, just about different things.
Sure.
And one of them is going to say, do you remember when Okna killed the bison? And then somebody will go, Okna, face the giant bison with a broken leg. This right. never changes. And it's how we remember our history, mythical great figures, Teddy Roosevelt. What do people know about Teddy Roosevelt? Charging up San Juan Hill. People are so accustomed to hearing stories and passing along stories, whether it's in the form of gossip or whether it's in repeating something they see on TV or reminiscing about a sporting event, and I could go on and on. You would all understand that storytelling is such an ancient art form that it is, I believe, underappreciated in that this is how you can reach people. Right. Now, there are a couple of things that strike me as people are often underestimating or overestimating their power. Now, here's something that people underestimate. And that is when you tell a story that is about essentially the values of the person you're talking to, that is about things they love or that are important to them, you have their attention.
Yeah.
Because they can so easily place themselves in the tale. And here's something that people overestimate. They overestimate the need to self-aggrandize. When you tell a story and you are the hero, you're not doing yourself any big favors. You're hamstringing yourself. Because when you tell a story when you are the hero, you are no longer standing next to the person talking to them. You are putting yourself up on a box and asking to be worshiped. And there's this marvelous quote from George Orwell where he says, no autobiography is to be trusted unless it reveals something disgraceful. Any man who gives a good account of himself is probably lying, because any life when looked at from the inside is little more than a series of defeats.
Yeah.
And when I read that, yeah. Go ahead, sir.
I'll tell you, the ones for me, the ones that have really resonated, the ones that have had additional life online, is where I was very self-deprecating. A scenario where I really screwed up. And then of course there's the lesson in the loss or something of that. But I think it's a good transition, because I know for many who are watching or listening, want to talk about your stories. And for those who haven't, go on Instagram, go on TikTok, go on YouTube, and search up Neil Ford, Foard. And some of the most profoundly inspirational, I think the mechanism for how you record it, the melodic, soft voice in which you do it, tell the stories. I want to talk to you about how it's just remarkable sound, but it's so kind and revealing and anecdotal, with always a clear purpose at the end. Talk to us before we go into some of the specifics. What was the genesis, and what did you hope to get out of them when you started doing them?
I'll tell you what the basic impetus for the stories was: the fact that my daughter never met my dad. And it's the thing where I always go, oh God, that's so sad.
Yeah.
He would have loved her, and she him, because he was, and by the way, there's kind of interesting thing about my voice in particular. It's my dad's voice. When I hear it, I go, oh yeah, that's the old man. And I can hear him in my head. And I find myself more and more as I get older speaking like he used to speak. He sounded like an old film noir movie from the 40s. He had these turns of phrases that were right out of an Alan Ladd detective movie.
Oh, and, fun.
He would say, I ain't going to shave any ice, you read me? And he would say stuff like that. But in any case, because my daughter never met my dad, I felt like it was important to tell her some stories about him. And in particular, the things that I learned from him. And so that was sort of the starting point. It was a kind of a record, if you will, of the things that were important to me. What I discovered from people's comments and the things that they would share, like a couple of these videos went pretty, it's pretty viral, you know, like, and people would say, oh my God, you know, thank you for this. It reminds me that we're not all bad. And I thought, oh yeah, now that you mention it, the media that we get soaked in by and large is, it's kind of negative. I mean, let's face it, TV news feels like it's their obligation is to, you know, keep us in a perpetual panic. You know, it feels like their job is to say, see this problem way over here, thousands of miles away,
right,
that are life-threatening to those people? That's your problem.
But in a way, Neil, it's also low-hanging fruit, isn't it?
You
think about, and I'm taking off subject for a minute, we'll go back. You think about sort of the classic horror movies, the ones that really built suspense, the Rosemary's Baby, the things that scarred us in our youth, right?
Right.
Today, it's the low-hanging fruit. It's somebody jumping out and stabbing him in the chest, right? It's really easy at the end of a romance to kill off the protagonist to elicit tears. It's lazy.
Yeah.
But the stories that you do are, they're real, they're relatable, they're inspirational. And so when you started them as sort of that love letter to your dad through your daughter, or to your daughter from your dad.
Yeah, exactly.
How did the feedback drive future videos?
I got a sense that people treated the videos almost like an aspirin tablet for some kind of pain they were feeling. And so I thought, you know what I'm going to do is I'm just going to keep telling all the stories that I can from my own personal experience, because in spite of the fact that we keep hearing how awful we all are and how we're all at each other's throats, my experience was actually pretty good. Now, in other words, I was starting to notice these people are holding the door open for you, or they're letting you in traffic. And, you know, for every time somebody cuts you off in traffic, I'll bet you there's a case where somebody let you in.
Or five.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Exactly. Because
little Anne Frank there, right?
If you just started to pay attention, what you're going to discover is that the reason people don't make a big deal out of the small courtesies every day is because they are so abundant, they're not news.
Right.
They're so common that you're not, to you, the default setting is, you know, that people say thank you and they mean it. And, you know, my experience in New York City. Oh man, I loved New York. My experience in New York City was, it had this reputation for everybody being all abrupt and nasty, and that was not my experience at all. They're actually remarkably sentimental, you know, and sweet.
Yeah.
Now, it comes off as brusque because they're impatient, because they're in a hurry. But I, you know, every diner, you know, case and people that were, they got this brilliant sense of humor where it seems like they're being terse, but in fact, they're just winking at you like, you know, hey, it's all going to be all right, you know, relax. And you know what, all over America, whether it's Wyoming or San Francisco or Los Angeles or New York, it's all the same deal. It's just different styles. But you know what, people are pretty much 96% pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And you know what, you know where we get in trouble is where you start to think that's not true. And then you feel like a sucker for being cool. And that's because we keep getting banged over the head that we're all trash and everything's a train wreck and a dumpster fire. It's like, no.
Well, the minute you put yourself out there, you know, you can put a picture of a golden retriever puppy online and you'll be lambasted in 5 minutes. What, you hate cats?
Somebody.
Oh, you're somebody. Into animal bondage, right?
Yeah.
But I don't, you think, and maybe coming out of COVID is part of it, but I think it's universal. Is I think what you do, and I'm going to gush over you for a minute. I think what you do is I think you give people a pause for a great story. I got to believe that your stuff has got to be some of the most forwarded. I forward it to my kids. I mean, my kids are all sort of 19 to 28 years old, and I forward it to them to see it. And isn't it the same thing that's driving this passion behind Ted Lasso, for example?
Yeah.
Right? Boy. Just a little kindness and optimism as a reprieve. And it's one of the shows I put off for a while because I was like, yeah, it's the fish out of water. I get the ugly American kind of thing. And people are like, no. And I came to realize a couple episodes in, it's not the show I thought it was going to be.
I was exactly the same way, David. Precisely the same way. I didn't realize that superficially, that it wasn't super.
Yeah, he's a buffoon. Got it.
Right.
No, he's not. He's complex and he's deep and he's kind.
There's something else about Ted Lasso that I think is really significant and important. And that is that you know, Americans do have a kind of global reputation that is very, it's varied, right?
Sure.
So we think as Americans that we make awful tourists. Actually, the market research out there in the world is no, people kind of like Americans.
Yeah.
Number one, we overtip.
Right.
But two, despite the reputation of Americans, we are more likely to try to learn the local language. We are very generous and very sweet natured. We smile at people, which is unexpected in certain places, yeah. You know, like Denmark or whatever. But
France, yeah.
But yeah, but at the Ted Lasso quality that he brings to that show is actually, it's based on people's real experience with Americans, which is we are well-meaning bumpkins. We are, yeah. We are not sophisticated, but we sure are, our heart's in the right place. And Canadians, same way. And Australians. Canadians, Australians, Americans, you'll find that despite our reputations internally, we're kind of well-liked. Now, that is completely independent of whatever various governments do. Okay, so.
Absolutely.
Whatever the administrations do, the national character is actually kind of sweet-natured. And what happens is the more oxygen you give to our negative impression, the more people feel like that's how they ought to behave.
Right.
And I part of my impulse in doing the stories is to try to be an antidote and try to be a reminder that people are actually pretty cool. Some of the things I've seen and heard as a result of being out there and some of the feedback I'm getting is really encouraging.
Isn't it heartwarming for even personally to know that you're making a difference? But let me ask you a question, because my first book was sort of this sappy dad book. And it was just when I was turning 40, and I'll be 60 this year. It was kind of a love letter to my kids. I'm sort of like, if I look back at the end of my life, what do I want to have learned and earned and loved and lost? And I found myself just the exercise of mining my life because my publisher had deadlines and I had to have certain amount of words written. And I would take Fridays off for about 2 months. And I would just try and think of the stories. I mean, it's so easy for people to tell the starfish story or other crap like that. But as I listen to your stories, of course, they're about you and the experiences that you had, but they're so universal. How do you mine? How do you choose which stories? How do you realize, oh my God, I got to come up with a story for this week's video? What's your process for that?
Right. And so what I will be doing is I will literally go, I will think about a year. Like I'll go, okay, you know, 1975, what was happening?
Where was I?
In my head back then, 1985, 1995. And I'm trying to find the right page so you can see it because it's pretty funny. Some of the notes that I make myself, but I'll really just go back in time and think what happened that year. And in general, and to go back to the Orwell quote, in general, it's some mistake I made. Like, I'll beat myself up and then I'll say, you know what? You know how I can get over beating myself up by this? I'm going to make something out of this. I'm going to tell people the lesson that I learned from this mistake and little things I did that were inadvertently racist that I wasn't aware of. And
I shared a story like that.
Did you?
Oh yeah. In my sappy dad book. Well, look at that. That's great. For those watching the video version, watch the video and you can see as well. That's great. And you have great artistic penmanship. Mine would be chicken scratch. And then from that, do you develop? Because here's one of the things I love about your stories as well, is they have characters. They have dialogue. It's not so-and-so said this. Is when so-and-so says this, you say it as them saying this, right?
That got me into trouble, by the way, David.
Oh, I can imagine, because there'll always be those sensitive saying you're mocking, but nobody who watches your stuff thinks for a minute that you're mocking any particular ethnicity. But let them.
It's happened. I felt so awful, by the way. Oh my God, David, the sensation that you feel when you know that somebody thought you were disrespecting somebody.
It's the hardest thing in our business though, Neil. You know, when I started speaking, somebody said, listen, 5% of your audience will not like you no matter what you do. And you can say it's about them, but there's something else. I got heckled once. I was speaking, I mentioned a huge event for the National Association of Realtors. No. And I mentioned something about Chick-fil-A and they're screaming, they hate gays.
I'm okay.
I took a pause and I said, all right, let's move on. I'd love to have a conversation with you, but can we move forward? But
yeah.
Boy, I'm telling you, if we so worried about, if we come with a good heart and there's nothing that's overtly if you worry about everybody, you wouldn't be posting content.
Yeah. And you know,
how do you strike that balance?
Okay.
Recognizing them?
Here's the thing is that when this, like I say, this really got to me. It got to me because I had only the best intentions. I'll tell you the story if you don't mind.
No, please.
It goes like this.
We have as much time as you want.
When I was in Hong Kong, I lived there for 2 years and I was completely out of my depth. People don't really understand how incredibly different Chinese culture is from Occidental culture.
Right.
And you know, I discovered just how stupid I was when I was out there. Well, as it happened, I had a friend who was from Mumbai, and he was incredibly intelligent. And he had this, to my ear, his English was gorgeous. It was soft and elegant. His diction was beautiful. His choice of words was so lyrical and educated that in my head, when I was imitating him, it was a love letter to this, how I saw this guy.
Right.
But it was an Indian accent.
Sure.
And I'm going to just say one phrase in particular.
You have permission on this show. We've all heard the pre-qualification of this.
Okay.
But you know, weren't doing horrible stereotypes of
convenience
stores or things like that. No, this is honest. Go ahead.
So what happened? You're free. There was this, at the end of the story was basically about how I had had an incident that happened and it had opened a kind of window of consciousness briefly.
One of my favorite stories that you've told.
Oh, I love that one.
Oh my God.
And what had happened was that a neuroscientist who I had met at a party in Menlo Park had explained to me the physiology, the brain chemistry that had led to that. And then it wasn't any great revelation. It was simply, it was an experience of opioids. Self-generated opioids creating a sensation was
high. And in doing so, for those who haven't seen it, he diminished your experience by just dismissing it as chemicals in your blood.
To be fair to him, he didn't realize that
right.
I had interpreted it in incredibly mystical ways. Okay?
Right.
So all he was doing was he was just saying, oh, just to inform you about why that happened, it happened like this. And I was very crestfallen because I thought, and here I thought it was this profound revealing moment. Okay. So then years and years go by. And then I tell Kieran, this man I respect, I told him the story and his version of it was quite different. And he was disappointed in the neuroscientist. And the last line he said was, for all his intelligence, he belittles the profound. And I thought, oh, what a beautiful phrase. And it rolled off his tongue.
In a beautiful, beautiful dialect.
Exactly. To my ear,
yeah.
Indian accented English is some of the most pleasant. Okay.
Sure.
But unfortunately, for some people, they interpreted that as me. I don't know. You know,
they would say mocking.
Yeah.
And you were reliving and reflecting.
And so my daughter says to me, she can tell.
And how old is she, by the way?
She's 22.
Okay.
So she says to me, look, I don't let it bother you, but let me just fill you in. If you're worried about something like that, then let me ask you a question. If he was standing right in front of you right now, would you use that accent? And interesting. In other words, if you're gonna use a story and you're gonna tell a story like this, just try to picture the people sitting right in front of you and then ask yourself if you would tell it that way. And you know what? I thought, oh, okay, you know, maybe not. Maybe I'm not. And so it's a learning. It was a learning experience.
But it's a good sensitivity to have. But I'll tell you, and we're going back to story, is stories have characters and stories have textures and heroes. And of course, and it's never you. And there was something Gandhi-esque about your presentation of that story that added a layer, a texture of wisdom. And it's the final line of that. I actually wrote it down. So, I mean, that's how profound. And for those who are watching and listening, remind us what that story, that vignette is called.
It's called What Actually Went Down.
Okay. Neil Ford, What Actually Went Down. I encourage you. We're short on time, but that one probably touched me the most. There was other ones, the one about the guy in the future or who sent the note with the, the circuit board.
I love that story. Oh, true story. God. I mean, they're, by and large, they're all true stories.
Yeah. And that's the best part of it. And I'd love to go into all, I encourage everybody who is watching and listening. This is your daily Ted Lasso. You want the high concept pitch, the high concept pitch. This is Paul Harvey meets Ted Lasso. And
David, that's very quickly wisdom. Becoming a fan of yours.
Yeah. No, please stop. Please. No more. Stop. But no, look him up. Look him up. So here's a couple of questions. So besides continuing, which of course we always hope you do, just as we hope that what's his name kept writing Calvin and Hobbes forever, but there was an end at some point. I look at it, this is things like, this is my comfort. This is what I, you know, in addition to some inappropriate stuff I send to my brothers, just because it's fun. Because we're guys. And for those listening, please don't get offended. I'm not talking about horribly cruel. It's just funny things. This is my daily or every other day Ted Lasso. Is this a book?
Yeah.
Do you take what becomes 50, 60,000 words and realize I'm going to take the best of the best, right? Rewrite it for the page. And
I'm working on that right now. I have a wonderful woman out in New Jersey.
I figured. All right. Quick speed round that we do at the end. You ready for this?
Ready.
Okay. I'm going to put on my smart guy glasses to do this. Okay. speed round. What was your most unexpected comment or response to a video?
Well, sorry. Wow. I'm blowing the speed round thing.
No, it's all right.
Let me answer that two ways, if you don't mind. So the first way is the unexpected comment or response was, holy cow, this got a big response. In other words, I was astonished at how people felt the way I felt. You know, there's a lesson in that, by the way, David.
Right.
We are not meant to face this life alone. We are not meant to take this journey alone. And if there was one thing that just absolutely put the wind into my sails, it was, holy cow, Neil, there's a lot of people out there who feel like you feel. Oh my God, that ought to make you feel pretty good. It's, you know what? We're not so bad. Okay, so that was one reaction. And then the second unexpected reaction was when people went after me for the accent thing, and that really hurt. It hurt because I could see their point.
And it was well-intentioned, and you didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And
I didn't mean you to. But yeah. when I saw that I did, I thought, oh, dang, that's shoot. You know, there's nothing makes you flinch as much as when you know you're kind of wrong.
Yeah.
Or if not wrong, at least you were being insensitive. And that's when I really get angry is when I get mad at myself. Yeah. So that was
Right. But there's a story in the mea culpa as well.
Maybe.
That might come out of that as well. Yeah. Here's the other question. What do you hope will come of this?
Well, as I say, I don't think we're meant to take on life alone. And what's happened between our media and things like the pandemic and you know, recessions or what have you, people often feel like they're in competition with one another. I think they are artificially inflating the degree to which we are in competition, and that the human species, our great superpower that people don't seem to recognize, is our capacity for teamwork and cooperation and the thirst for togetherness. I think American culture is being sold a bill of goods that the most admirable figure is the lone cowboy doing things on their own, the great man, man who would succeed no matter what, as opposed to somebody who is really, really good at helping people cooperate and work together and join as a unit and celebrate their triumphs as a team. I'll ask you a sincere question. David, if you could get an Olympic gold medal in any sport, which one would it be?
Legitimate sport?
Yeah.
Boy, that's a good one. Javelin catching. Oh, wait, that's not a real one. That's not a real one. Yikes. I try to draw a distinction between the ones I enjoy watching and what I would like to participate in.
Okay.
Probably some. My father was a huge UCLA fan. He grew up in Southern Cal. And so we love to watch track and field together. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to be the fastest man in the world. How's that?
I feel you there. Who doesn't want to be a Usain Bolt? But I'll tell you why I asked the question. Because if you could have been a member of the 1980 men's Olympic hockey
team. There you go. Yeah. Do you believe in miracles? Yes. Oh. Al Michaels, the best.
Herb Brooks, the coach of that team.
Yeah.
His very famous remark was, I don't want the best players. I want the right players. And he needed people who would die before they would let their teammates down. And he got them. And what if I remember thinking that if you had won a gold medal on that team, you could be 95 years old and still find somebody who felt that feeling. Like that team, do you know what I mean? Can you imagine?
Remember like it was yesterday. Like it was
right.
Because everything came together. It was a team. They were underdogs. They were college kids against the pseudo-professional Russians. The unexpected, the joy.
But okay, so you've nailed it with that word. Because it was the joy. It was the shared joy.
Yeah.
You're just not going to have that same sense when you can be the world's fastest man and you can win a gold medal in the 100 meter. But 20 years from now, you won't be able to sit with somebody and have a beer and have them know how you feel because they felt it too, because they were there. And because you share it, because it was mutually won, it amplifies the joy. And I think this is something underestimated by us and that one we ought to work a little harder for. This is what I'm hoping for.
And I'm saying is that part of what's driving you is recognizing that what you're sharing is your story, but it's our collective experience.
The feedback I was getting, the sudden recognition that other people felt how I felt, that was so reassuring to me.
Yeah.
It was so like food and drink to me that I think, oh, if I can get these messages out into the world and make somebody else feel like they're not alone, then you know what? Mission accomplished. It'll be like my personal gold medal.
Great conversation with the amazing and profound Neil Ford. What a good man you are. I really appreciate the time. If people want to get in touch with you, what formal channel can they do? How can they look you up besides the...
I'm super easy. Yeah. I'm super easy because I'm the only one on earth that spells the name, my name on the way I do. So it's NEALFOARD. And it's just neilford@gmail.com. Just email me. And I also have a company. I will teach storytelling and I teach brand communications. And I go under the URL passionatelogic.com. But again, if you want to just reach out to me,
what an opportunity to sit at the feet of the master. I really encourage you. You'll get hooked. But watch the videos on, I watch them on TikTok for as long as that's going to be around,
right.
YouTube and Instagram as well. And
send them to YouTube.
Consume it, drink this up with a spoon and share it with others. I think this is a spark that becomes a brush fire. I think your brand is being built and refined almost inadvertently, but I appreciate the friendship. I appreciate the stories. It's one of those things that I think people who watch this will feel like they know you. And I think the authenticity with which you ply your trade validates that. I think they do know you. I think we do know you by the stories that you tell. And I appreciate that, my friend.
Wow, David, I appreciate that remark.
That's it. Hang on. We're going to talk on the other end. Quick self-promotion. Big thanks to Neil Ford. You can pick up a copy of my new book. I'm going to grab it here from underneath here. It's called The Morning Huddle. Like Neil does, it's stories. It's sparking conversation. And the tagline is powerful customer experience conversations to wake you up and shake you up and win more business. In fact, all of my books that are strategically located next to my head are available on Amazon.com. And be sure to click to like this podcast. That's important. Subscribe. You'll hear these great conversations as we go into the new year. And then click the little bell icon to receive notifications and new events. Leave a comment. That's important as well. And if you want to learn more about my keynote speaking, my consulting, look me up at davidavarin.com. Big thanks to my friend Neil Ford. Look him up, watch his videos. And that's it. I'm David Avarin. Be good.
This has been the Why Customers Leave podcast with David Averin. Be sure to leave a comment and click the like button. You can listen to or watch past episodes and be notified of future ones by hitting the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform or check them out on David Averin's YouTube channel. David's popular books are all available online and also in Kindle and audiobook form as well. You can learn more about David's keynote speaking and business consulting at davidaverin.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.